comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thanks for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on Earth, that's a guarantee. I'm here because it matters, and so do you. Have you checked out the webpage? If you check out the webpage, you'll see there's something new in that upper right-hand corner. One of our members suggested that I make a ringtone of the first few seconds of our theme music. And so I have done so. And you can download it, all right? It's MP3 format. You'll have to follow. I can't tell you how to install it on your phone. You'll have to follow whatever instructions your phone manufacturer says to do in order to install a ringtone, but it's there and it's free, and enjoy. Hope you like it. The K-Files e-zine is our free weekly newsletter. If you don't subscribe to the K-Files e-zine, you're sitting in the dark. Believe me, you are. There's a great deal more information that we never get to talk about on the show. We get to a lot of stuff on the show, but we don't get it all. And so more of it goes into the K-Files e-zine. It's absolutely free. There is no genius at all in being a mushroom. And if you sit in the dark and get nothing but that steady stream, that steady diet of crap off of the major media, that's the definition of a mushroom. Don't be one. You don't have to. It's just a choice. All you have to do is click where it says K-Files e-zine and subscribe. It's free. You can unsubscribe anytime you want to. Sales of my new ebook are going well, and reviews, feedback, comments are going well. So if you don't have your copy yet, be sure you get it. It's called Mars Maximum Mystery. Now, you know a lot of the mysteries about Mars. Over the years, there have been tons of shows done on that subject, not only here, but other shows. Over the years, there have been tons and tons of conference speakers who have talked about and have shown photographs of these mysteries on Mars. But do you know the maximum mystery? If you don't, you need to get my book. It's an ebook. You download it. When you pay for it, you download it immediately. It's $9. And for $9, you get the ebook and you get to watch the show that I did about that. And that's a pretty doggone good deal, if I say so myself. That's a real good deal. It's called Mars Maximum Mystery. Get it, read it, and I think you're going to be pretty much amazed at the things that you'll see in there. And I'll tell you in there the maximum mystery. Also, I have an ebook out. It's a little smaller, but it's about Venus. It's smaller because there's not as much information and photographs available to us about Venus. But with Venus, it's called Venus Watch the Other Hand. You need to get it too. We'll be back right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Henry Kroll. Henry Kroll has written a book called Cosmological Ice Ages, in which he explores some, I would say, a lot more than interesting questions, and comes to some very interesting conclusions. And from Alaska, Henry Kroll joins us this evening. Henry, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Well, thank you very much for having me on the air. It's an honor and a privilege to be here.
Henry, before we get into this, the subject matter, the content, the meat of this book, tell us a little bit about how you got even interested in researching all of this. What got you started in this?
Well, I'm a pretty old guy, and I read and study everything in Scientific American and everything all my life, especially biology and geology, and I've been to three universities and had two wives, 11 grandchildren, four planes, etc., four fishing boats. And I was reading Scientific American one day, and I noticed the Antarctic ice core graphs. They drill down through Antarctica, and they can get back into about 3 million-year-old ice, or half a million. The ones I was looking at went back 400,000 years. And I noticed a regular cycle in the drop of carbon dioxide. Of course, there's also measures temperature and methane and dust and snowfall, some of these graphs. So anyway, anytime you got a regular cycle like that, and of course.
Well, Henry, we have.
I can mop up CO2.
Yeah, we lost your audio there for about 5 seconds, so back up. You must be on a cordless phone. Yeah, well, we've lost your audio, so we're going to disconnect, and we will call you back. Cordless phones never work. Never. Always remember, ladies and gentlemen, cordless phones are radios. Did you know that? They really are. They're radios. All right, let's give Henry a redial here and see if we can get him. One ringy dingy. Two ringy dingies. No ringy dingies. I don't know. Maybe they're in a storm or something there in Alaska. But absolutely no audio coming from Henry. Shows the lines connected, but there's no audio. Okay, so we'll try it again. If it doesn't work, we'll have to go to open line. I hate to do that because this is a fascinating book and fascinating stuff that Henry has researched and written about, and I really want you to be exposed to it. So we'll give it one more shot here. And there's the problem apparently is on the phone lines, not our system. Our system's working fine. Maybe not his system, but somewhere between here and Alaska may be some difficulty. Two ringy dingies. And three. And four. Is anyone home? All right. Well, we have Henry on the other line. That will work until break time, and then we'll have to go to the other phone line. There we go. Henry, are you back with us?
Yeah, I don't know. I switched the phone over here, and I don't know what's wrong with this system, but anyway, as I was saying, I was looking around for our sun for something that would impart additional light and heat to Earth. And I just couldn't make that mental leap, so I called my friend in Seattle, and he'd already found an object that we're heading toward at 7.5 kilometers per second.
Okay, now let's clarify for everyone, why were you looking for an object that would impart additional light and heat? Why was that necessary?
Well, our sun doesn't suddenly change its spectrum into the UV to mop up carbon dioxide on Earth, and it doesn't flare up very much, especially over long periods of time. And in fact, in ancient times, it didn't burn as hot as it does today, and it obviously doesn't have enough power to keep us out of ice ages. Otherwise, we wouldn't have them.
Okay, fair enough. So we're headed toward an object at 7.5 kilometers per second.
Yes, and it just happens to be, you know, a very large star. It's about 2 solar masses, and it has a little white dwarf that orbits around it every 54 years. And that object puts out more than 100 times the UV light, ultraviolet light of our sun. But scientists don't seem to register with them because it's invisible light. It's above the range of human sight. And it could put out as much as 1,000 times the UV of our sun when it gets in close to its host star. It's a white dwarf, and it used to be 6 solar masses eons ago before it shrank down to 1.5 solar masses. This object is only about the size of the Earth, but it's 1.5 times the mass of our sun, and 1.5, you know, a little more gravity than our sun, at half again as much.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, this star that we're headed toward, does it have a name?
Oh, yes. It's Cirrus. It's the brightest star in the sky. It's Cirrus A and B. And there could possibly be a third object in the area. We don't know what it is, you know, because there's a little wobble to its orbits that tend to indicate that. And some ancient African tribes, the Dogon, say there are 3 objects over there. Who knows, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, this Cirrus B is very intense light, and you can't see the light. It's above the range of human sight, but it's in the right spectrum to make plants grow in the 350 to 400 nanometer wavelength. And I wanted to know where our sun was going after that point, and I started reading up on it, and I have a huge encyclopedia set, Britannica and other reference books laying around the house. I have about a ton or more of books, and I discovered that we're actually heading in the opposite direction at 19.5 kilometers a second, and leaving, and I wanted to know where our sun was born, so I drew a line on a constellation map and extended it out past the center from the object that we're heading for in the opposite direction, and we're heading toward Hercules, according to 2 astronomers who measured the redshift of over 2,500 stars over a period of years and compiled it in a computer to determine we're heading toward Hercules at 19.5 kilometers a second. So I reversed that course. I pilot boats and planes all my life, so I figured, well, somebody should figure this out. You know, I sort of drew a line on a chart, and it winds up in Orion, and Orion just happens to be the nearest birthing place of stars, and we're leaving the area, so basic logic says that our sun was born in Orion.
Okay, so our sun is leaving Orion, and it's headed toward Hercules, right?
That's correct. And Orion is upstream in the galactic arm, and they call it the Orion arm that we live in. The galaxy is billions of stars, and it rotates once every 250 million years, and we're being forced out of the Orion by the galaxy's rotation. It's rotating faster than the gravity of the galaxy can hang on to its stars. So in other words, it's expanding slightly. But we seem to be accelerating away from Orion because our velocity is more than what it takes to be where we are now. Orion is only 1,330 light years to the south of us, and Cirrus is in the same general direction. So the Cirrus is moving toward Hercules a little faster than we are. We appear to be heading toward Cirrus at 7.5 kilometers a second, but if you add the two velocities together, it comes out to where Cirrus and Procyon and some other stars are moving toward Hercules at 27.5 kilometers a second. Now, I hope I haven't lost anybody there.
No, I understand. It kind of gives us a false sense that we're moving towards Cirrus, because it's actually, we're not, but it's actually catching up to us at 7.5 kilometers per second.
Right, but when you start looking at the gravity mass figures, gravity being proportional to mass, and also in that particular direction that we're leaving from Orion, that means that's the galactic gravity. So you have to multiply the difference in mass times 4 to figure the actual gravity, sort of, get a rough estimate. Let's call it rule of thumb. But anyway, Cirrus being A and B together, 3.5 solar masses, and the Sun has a mass of 2 with 30 zeros behind it in kilograms. And Cirrus A and B is 6.8 E30, so basically it has 3.5 solar masses. And then Procyon over there at 10.4 light years, a little further away, it has 2 solar masses, so plus its white dwarf, and we can't find any data on that. So there's a lot of gravity over in that neighborhood. If you multiply, just for Cirrus alone, if you multiply 3.5 solar masses times 4, that would mean it would have about 14 times the gravity of our Sun. And my same thing with Procyon, it would be 8 times the gravity of our Sun. So you add up all that gravity and it comes out to about 25 times the gravity of our Sun. And that means if you took a spaceship, say a chemical rocket, primitive one like we have, and you headed towards Cirrus, you'd only have to travel about 12 or 13% of the distance, and the gravity over in that neighborhood would continue pulling you in. So you could shut your rockets off, and you could travel without any more power in that direction.
All right.
If you were traveling from Cirrus toward us, you'd have to have over 10 times the amount of fuel on board to get anywhere.
Yeah, I can understand. Okay, so we're headed towards this Hercules constellation.
Yes.
And
it's a reference point that's outside the galaxy that astronomers use to measure distances and also velocities.
Okay, so if our Sun was born in the Orion star system, or the Orion galaxy, our Sun is born over there. It gets slung this direction because of the spin of that galaxy.
And there's also been a series of explosions in Orion. Sometimes a big star will blow up over that way over the hundreds of millions of years, over the 6 billion lifespan of our Sun. And those tend to push us out a little faster each time something goes off over in that neighborhood.
All right, now I've heard a lot of different theories about the formation of this planet. Some people say that it was formed right here in this solar system. Some say that it was not formed in this solar system, but sort of got kicked over into this solar system and captured by the Sun's gravity. What do you say about that? Where did the Earth come from?
It appears to me that the Earth was formed in the solar system. It just, the Saturn and Jupiter are both large gas planets, and they just mop up the remaining material after a Sun is formed. They start clumping together, and eventually wherever the largest volume material is, you're going to have a larger planet, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in closer to the Sun, you probably wouldn't have so much material, so the planets would be smaller, in theory. Of course, there is some planet swapping, and moon swapping goes on all the time, you know. And
okay, so when the Earth was formed,
from this solar system,
when the Earth was formed, was it one of these boiling hot masses of molten stuff, or was it, what was it, frozen or hot? What was it, what were the conditions when this was formed?
I believe that the atmospheres of these planets, your gas planets, were formed by the volcanism and the boiling hot material. However, after we left Orion, you get out into the colder space. Earth had a very high pressure atmosphere, but it also had a lot of water on it, and there are ice and on the moons of Jupiter and Saturn also, so water seems to be a common formation in these solar systems. And it froze up for more than 1 billion years. The whole planet of Earth was covered with ice, but it may have had a molten core underneath. It just crusted over from remaining dust, and then it formed enough atmosphere where it completely blocked the sunlight. At 750 pound per square inch atmosphere, you couldn't see the sun, and its atmosphere extended about 2,500 miles above the planet. Now, right now, we have a 14.5 pound per square inch atmosphere at sea level, so if you take a little hand calculator, if you go up 50 miles right now, you're out of the atmosphere. So you take 14.5 and divide it into 750 pound per square inch and multiply it by 50 miles, it comes out to 2,500 miles. So our ancient atmosphere was quite thick, and sunlight could barely get through it, if all. So there was just no possible way for life to get started on the planet, you know. We're out there in this billion-year ice age. The only life that they can find in that time were bacteria, and they made rock formations called stromalites in Australia and in northern Canada. But they were, you know, during a warm period somewhere in there, but the rest of the time it was froze up. So what happened? The only possible explanation I can come up with that we got out of that billion-year ice age is that we drifted between these other stars that were swapped into the galaxy, I think. Procyon and Cirrus are very strange objects because they both have these white dwarfs. And Cirrus's white dwarf used to be six solar masses. In other words, it was six times more larger than the sun.
All right, we have to step away for a break for just a moment, and we'll pick up there when we come back. My guest, Henry Kroll, don't go away. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Henry Kroll. Henry, we had to step away for a break right in mid-sentence there, so I want to give you a chance to finish your thought.
Well, thank you for having me on. My name, you can call me Hank Kroll.
Oh, okay, Hank.
Captain Hank Kroll is in Captain Jack Sparrow in the movie Pirates of the Caribbean, you know.
All right.
I'm a loose cannon, a science heretic.
Okay.
Things that I study are, you know, and there's a good, strong science religion out there. They don't want to upset the status quo. They want to keep us prisoner down here on the planet, appears.
That is so true. All right. Now, we went through this warming as we got close to Cirrus and what was the other one?
There are two large stars that rule our cluster of 100 stars that we exist in, that we live in, and they're called Cirrus and Procyon, and they're to the south of us. Cirrus is the brightest star in the sky, and it's below and to the left of the three stars in Orion's belt. It's near the horizon up here in Alaska.
Okay, well, explain for us, if our atmosphere at that time, during the first billion years or so, if our atmosphere was 750 pounds per square inch at surface, how did it get down to 14.5 pounds?
Well, that's a good question. We got that information by mainstream sources. The source was
50 bars, which works out to about 750 psi. And the only thing that can take an atmosphere down is some of it's lost due to stellar winds or solar winds from our own sun. But the other big consumer of atmosphere is plant growth, photosynthesis. In order to have plant growth, you got to have an input of light, and it's got to be in the right spectrum, and it's got to reach the surface of the Earth. So we got between Procyon and Cirrus in what they call a mutual gravity point, possibly closer to Cirrus, and then little Cirrus B being having more gravity than our sun probably matched our speed and put us into orbit around the two solar mass star Cirrus A. And we were following this little tractor beam there for about 650 million years all through the Cambrian era up to the present time. And the additional light input from this small object and the heat and light from the other larger stars got through the Earth's thick atmosphere to get the plants growing in the oceans to release free oxygen and also allowing animals to exist. You know, they had to have the plant food, and you had to have some inventions called non-cyclic photosynthesis in order to get adequate food production for animals to exist.
Okay, so the plants get started, and then the animals in the ocean. And so far, I haven't heard you mention the moon. We had no moon at this time?
The line that was brought in much more recently. We're still trying to get through the geologic eras of how all these limestone 12,000 foot thick layers on Earth were formed, and 100 foot thick layers of coal in Pennsylvania and Utah and also Virginia. In order to make 1 foot of hard coal takes 40 feet of carbon, trees and grass, stuff, carbon taken out of the air. You can't make coal out of nothing. You got to have the building block atoms of carbon, and it came, the only source is from the air, the atmosphere. So anyway, it took our atmosphere down, and during the time of the dinosaurs it was 30 to 100 pounds per square inch, which is more recent times. And they took plaster casts of dinosaur chest cavities about 5 years ago, and they determined they wouldn't survive in today's atmosphere because their lungs are way too small for their body mass. They couldn't breathe. So the atmosphere then had to be around 30 to 100 pounds per square inch. Venus right now has an atmospheric pressure of 117 pounds per square inch. And it's mostly carbon dioxide. So if Earth was similar to Venus, it would have been, you know, the same in early times with lots of carbon dioxide, which is plant food. Now our government wants to take all the CO2, which is now down to 0.033% in our atmosphere, and pump human release of CO2 underground, or put it into the soil somewhere so that they think it's a greenhouse gas that's going to cause global warming, you know, which is absolutely ridiculous because we are currently in an ice age.
Okay, whoa.
Started.
All right, park right there for a moment. Explain that to us. How do you know we're in an ice age?
The average temperature on Earth right now is 32 degrees. Look it up, you know. I got a temperature graph over here that I laminated that's about 4 feet long. I took it out of a Time Life book. All the past geologic ages when the dinosaurs were here and we made all that coal, oil, and limestone, the average temperature on Earth was 50 to 80 degrees. Some, it reached as high as 90 degrees, the average temperature, and there were no ice caps on the planet. But now we've got these big ice caps, and we've had them for 3 million years, roughly, about 3 million. And what happened is we were in this tight orbit close to Cirrus A and B, and it gave us all our carbon resources, our coal, oil, and limestone, with additional light input from those giant stars. And then there, about 3 million years ago, I looked all around us for something that would kick us out of our tight, comfortable orbit around Cirrus that kept Earth warm around, you know, up to 80, 90 degrees. And there was an explosion toward between us and Orion that made Barnard's Loop, and that explosion was so violent that it kicked three two solar mass stars out into a triangle formation at 200 kilometers per second. So the scientists in CERN, Switzerland, noticed this, and they put the data into a computer and they ran it backwards. One of the stars is Oumuagura, and I can't remember the other two. But anyway, they determined that the explosion went off about 3 million years ago. And there could have been enough force on that blast to cause our solar system to lose its tractor beam with Sirius B. It was a very delicate balance, gravitational-wise anyway, and it might have rearranged Sirius and Procyon to the point where we started getting out further away, making elliptical orbits around Sirius A, to where the first ice ages were only 10,000 years, and then 20, and then 30, and 50. Now they're up to 110,000 years, or somewhere between 105 and 110. And we go out now to 9 light years and practically stop. And we've been out here 8.5, 9 light years for quite a while. We've come about a tenth of a light year in the last 200 years or so, since we've noticed, since our technology and telescopes were invented to where we could even notice what those things were out there, that scientists didn't know that we're in orbit around them because they can't tell the movement, you see. They mm-hmm. just have no way to measure the movement, except for using the parallax, which is you take two stars and you measure the angles of them and try to determine the distance using arc seconds, you know. It's mm-hmm. delicate work, but anyway.
Okay, so we got kicked out of our tractor beam orbit around Sirius.
And we started making the ice caps on Earth, and we started having ice ages. And I did extensive research on the layers all over the Earth to try to figure out how many ice ages we have had in the last 3 million years, and it looks like about 58 of them, according to the squiggles on the graphs at the Antarctic ice core graphs and the benthic carbonate deposition on the ocean's floor. And I put those graphs in the book. The book is actually two volumes. It's all in one, and it's 8.5 by 11. It's 400 pages, almost 400 pages, and it's a really big, heavy book. You get two books for the price of one with this one. And the more esoteric data and the more historical data is in volume two. And I was kind of, you know, sarcastic and rough on the academics that teaches this stuff, because I was mad because they don't tell us this stuff. You know, we have to really dig the information out and put it together and figure it out for ourselves here in the private sector. But
well, you certainly don't have to apologize for that on this show, because on this show I call those guys intellectual mudsuckers.
Well, they really irritate me because they keep us in the dark all the time, you know, and I think it had something to do with, you know, Margaret Mead's studies of the civilizations in New Guinea and the islands in the Pacific. You know, whenever a more primitive society comes in contact with a technologically advanced civilization, then usually the more primitive one disintegrates, and the people there, they throw all cares to the wind, you know. They go throw their lives away, basically. They use alcohol and drugs and all that, and, you know, they don't care anymore.
All right, so here we are way out from Sirius. We have slowed down quite a bit in our escape from Sirius. What's going to happen? Do we reach the end of the rubber band and it snaps, or does it start to pull us back toward Sirius?
We're past the rubber band already. We were at 9 light years, and now we're at 8.5 light years heading back towards Sirius. This is the only reason why we were able to determine this, is because we're heading back that way, and we're picked up velocity very slightly. And I come up with a arrival time at Sirius of about 14,000 years.
From right now?
From right now, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got plenty of time to figure this out, and I'm really hoping that some university students grab onto this and write their papers on it and stuff. I furnish a lot of material here to fund major universities for the next 100 years in this book. There's so many ideas in there that they should be able to get grants for all of this stuff. I'm unfunded totally. I did it all on my own, and a lot of people came out of the woodwork to help me with this. I'm not an astronomer. In fact, I had little interest in astronomy. I knew where some of the constellations were when I started this book, but after we got interested in it, tried to figure out where we were going and where we came from, then I talked to my co-author there. I call him my co-author because he kept feeding data to me down there from Seattle. I called him up and, I said somebody has to write a book about this, and that's what got me started on it.
All right. At what point did we acquire the moon, and how did we acquire it?
Well, that chapter, I couldn't even believe it when I started. I just could not get it through my brain. I've been so brainwashed by the educational system that I was just assumed that the moon was formed with the Earth and had been up there billions of years. But when I started doing the research, it became obvious that it hasn't been up there that long. For example, just little simple things, like, for example, where are the moon meteorites? They've got about 12 pounds of Martian meteorites on Earth that they found, but they've only found about 13.2 pounds of lunar meteorites that we can find on the web anywhere. So, being that the moon is much, much closer to Earth than Mars, and it's just pockmarked with craters, literally, and it has very little atmosphere, we should be able to walk out there in the deserts of Arizona and Phoenix and just literally trip over lunar meteorites everywhere. We could pick them up and build houses out of lunar meteorites. But there's only found 13.2 pounds on the Earth. Now, what is that, And then there's a lot of weird things like that that indicate the moon really hasn't been up there that long.
All right, we have to step away for a break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Henry Kroll. Now, Henry, you were, when we stepped away for break, we were discussing how we acquired the moon, and you were telling us the reasons why it is implausible that the moon has been with us all along. So let's pick up there, and where did the moon come from?
Well, several of the other reasons, a couple of the other reasons I discovered why it hasn't been up there that long is some of the rocks they brought back from the lunar surface, one of them dated to 6 billion years old, which is older than our solar system, of course, and one of them dated to 20 billion years old, which is older than Big Bang Theory by about 10 billion years, 8 billion years, whatever. And so, this thing's very old, and it's been up there a very long time in space, older than the Earth, anyway. And then I didn't believe all of this when I started. I worked on it a whole year on this thing. The moon is going away from Earth about 3 centimeters per year. Now, that works out to about 30 yards in 1,000 years, which isn't very much, or 1 kilometer in 33,000 years. At the rate the moon left Earth about 10 billion years ago. But I don't think it's the case, because after the moon hit Earth, it would have slowed down. You just can't put a object like that up there in orbit without bouncing it off another object or the Earth itself. So I started looking around on Google Earth for some place it would bounce off from, and then, of course, I read authors Rand Flemeth, and also he wrote When the Sky Fell and Atlantis in Antarctica, and Charles Hapgood's books, Atlantis, Path to the Pole, and so forth and so on. And they always, and they corresponded with Einstein on this, and they all thought that the crust of the Earth slipped over somehow very quickly around 12,000 years ago. It's a crustal displacement theory, they call it. Since the crust, they figure, is floating on an ocean of liquid magma, and that it could actually slide around when it became unbalanced with the ice caps on the Earth. But I don't believe that that was the case. I think there was sufficient force you could actually shift the rotational pole of the Earth. So then I took an Encarta globe, which you can roll around any direction inside your computer there. I printed it out with where I thought the rotational pole was, because the Great Lakes line up in a crescent arc with Great Lake Victoria, Great Bear, and Great Slave Lakes. And I took a compass and drew a circle connecting all of those lakes and extended it around. In order to do that, that would mean the north rotational pole would be pretty close to the southern tip of Greenland. And the ice extended around to create the fjords of Norway. And that was where the ice cap was on the Earth before the moon hit.
Okay, so you're saying that the moon actually collided with the Earth, right?
Yes, I believe it did. So I was looking at a National Geographic, and I noticed how the oil wells on the North Slope in Alaska are sort of in a rough crescent that sort of matches the curve of the moon. And then I started looking at the Arctic Ocean itself, and it sort of matches about a third the diameter of the moon, the Arctic Ocean up there. And then I found a hydrographic map of the Arctic Ocean, and it's 5 kilometers deep in some places. That's a deep little ocean. The thing is, you know, very deep compared with the other little trenches around the other oceans on the globe, and the average depth of that Arctic Ocean is 1.3 kilometers. So that's when Brad kicked in. I was talking about this stuff, and he put the data in a computer he found online. It's called Arizona.edu/impact effects. Anyone can use it. And we put the mass of the moon in there, and the mass of the Earth. The mass of the Earth is 5.98 E^24 kilograms, and the moon's mass is 7.35 E^22 kilograms. But we figure the moon had ice on it because one side of it is smooth and it's been protected from meteor impacts. The side facing us is relatively smooth, and the only craters there seem to be rather fresh. You know, they have rays extending out from the craters. It means that they threw dust out, and they hit fairly recently after the ice was gone. So there was about 200 kilometers or more of ice on the moon. So I think it was brought in. We used an angle of 11 degrees and a speed of 2 kilometers per second, which is a minimum that we could figure it could roll back into orbit because it's tremendous mass. And we still on?
Yeah.
I got a beep there, a couple beeps, I don't know. But anyway, we use an angle of 11 degrees, speed of 2 kilometers a second, put it in that computer, and the data that came back is that it would depress the Earth's crust 5 kilometers. I found that rather synchronistic, since the Arctic Ocean is 5 kilometers deep on this, on the northern end of it there, on this side of it. And it's kind of a long trench, sort of. And it would have filled back in. It wasn't Earth rock hitting rock. The computer is based on rock hitting rock, so it was more like ice hitting ice and rock. And all of the camels and the horses and the mastodons and the tribes in North America were exterminated instantly. And they found these big mastodons with green food in their mouths and green food in their stomachs, you know. And some of the tribes, they say when they dig them up, they find they're looking up in the sky. And they're buried in gravel and muck. And methane ice and saltwater ice were dumped on the Earth, raised sea levels 300 feet or more. And I got some more data recently that I've added onto the book. We've hired a editor to redo the book again. I'm looking for a mainstream publisher, but I've got it out there now. It's available on Trafford, and anyone can look at over a rough copy of the thing and get an idea of what we're working on here and use the data.
All right, now, we've only got a minute and a half here before we get to our next break. So let me ask this. Where did the moon come from?
Well, that's another good question. I think it was, if you read Velikovsky's, he thought that Venus was brought into our solar system. He had a trilogy, Earth and Upheaval, and anyway, it could have come in with Venus. It might have been a moon of Venus, or it might be an object that they've used to terraform other planets. And by bringing the moon in, what it did, it tilted Earth 23.5 degrees in relation to the sun's rays, and it replenished the atmosphere with volcanism worldwide. And this tilting of the Earth doubles arable land, because now you've got sun's rays striking 1,800 miles further north and south as the Earth rotates around the sun. So it doubled the productivity of the oceans to release free oxygen to make the planet habitable for larger human and animal populations. It increased arable land, and, you know, just so that larger populations could live on the planet. It's been terraformed by someone who really knew what they were doing. If you go more than 23.5 degrees, you're going to have summers are going to be too hot and the winters too cold.
Okay, so what you're saying then is that this was done intelligently.
Purpose.
It was done on purpose.
Yeah. And there is one guy that gave mankind writing, architecture, mathematics, all of that, and healing, and he was known by different civilizations on Earth. The Egyptians knew him as Thoth. He's credited with stealing 5 days from the moon. See, I guess Earth had a 360-day year, which is an exact number of degrees in a circle. This is why we have a 360-degree circle today. And by hitting the Earth and bringing it out 11,712 years ago, he put it into a circular orbit around the sun instead of an elliptical orbit. He tilted it 23.5 degrees, and it took 5 days longer to orbit around the sun. So now we have a 365-day year, and a half, or quarter, I mean. And all of this was done in just one fell swoop, you know, by superior intelligence. The guy was also known as Hermes Trismegistus, or Trismegistus, which is Hermes three times great. Our politicians are still using Hermetic law, you know, as above, so below. He was known as Mercury by the Romans. He could fly around and cure the sick and deliver messages. If you go into any doctor's office in the nation, you see this spiral, two snakes wrapped around a central pole, and I believe that was the guts out of his flying saucer.
Oh, well, we're going to get back into that when we come back. We have to step away for a break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Henry Kroll. He says to call him Hank or Captain Hank, and he is the author of Cosmological Ice Ages. Welcome to those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour of the show. You have quite understandably missed a universe of information, but we're glad you're here now. And we're talking about how all of this got started. And Hank is describing for us how it all got started. Now, Hank, basically, your book starts out by you tracing the path of the sun backward. Yep. And then as you come forward, we get to a point some 11,700 years ago, and the moon shows up. You're telling us, you were telling us about this person,
well,
that the Egyptians called Thoth. Is the moon his spaceship, or is it artificial? And he drove it here?
Well, it might have belonged to his race or wherever he came from. There's a lot of data on the moon where they have these long straight lines that it could be a girders underneath the surface. And being as old as it is, it would have accumulated about 50 miles of dust and dirt over the many millions of years, or billions of years, let's put it that way. Could have been used to terraform other planets if it really is 20 billion years old. and they just might, you know, find planets like Earth and shove it over that way that need replenishing. Now, Earth had already lost 98% of its atmosphere when the moon was brought in. We went down from 750 PSI down to 14.5 pounds per square inch at sea level. So, you know, and the oxygen was being depleted, and by bringing the moon in, it increased the supply of oxygen with more plant growth on land and also plankton growth in the oceans. The coccolithophores and the diatoms that produce free oxygen and make our crude oil and stuff were started growing again. And it also increased volcanism, which replenishes the atmosphere by sublimating the limestone layers and releasing carbon dioxide and water back into the atmosphere from deep within the earth. The tectonic plates all along the Ring of Fire is being sublimated. It's remelting that limestone and it vents carbon dioxide. You know, human output of carbon dioxide is negligent compared with that. You know, and volcanoes actually, every time a major one goes off, it lowers global temperatures over 1 degree. But anyway, I'm pretty sure that's why it was brought in. It was to replenish Earth.
All right, so Thoth is...
We've lost our radiation shield since all the atmosphere is gone. But anyway, Thoth could fly around, I believe, and I put a lot of data in on the moon. You'd have to read the book. There's so much of it there, it's unbelievable.
All right, now, but Thoth is an intelligent extraterrestrial.
Well, apparently so. He was super intelligent, and if you look up his name on the internet, he wrote the 42 books of Thoth, which have to do with immortality. They haven't really been translated very well. He also wrote the Emerald Tablet and the Copper Scroll, and I saw a picture of it on the internet, and I forgot to cut and paste it in my computer, but they claim that it's more pure than any copper found on Earth, the Copper Scroll.
All right.
Anyway, the data is out there for people who are really interested in it. They can look it up.
All right. Now, were there other...
Spiral iron pipes.
Okay.
I also have the second book dealing with traveling to other star systems and ways of reducing the mass so you don't consume a lot of power to get there, you see. But Thoth's spiral iron pipes, he were filled with mercury. He was known as Mercury by the Romans. And if you take those two snakes and look at the esoteric data, what snakes represent, they represent time, because they could shed their skins and live forever. They were renewed themselves by shedding their skin. And this was an ancient symbol, goes way back even prior to the Egyptians. And when you have, it was more of an esoteric symbol that they were drawing, but I think it was spiral iron pipes wrapped around a central column filled with mercury. And when you rotate it, they're an angled upwards at around a 19.5-degree angle. The mercury would climb up into the pipes, and then they're forced into the top. When they reach the top, they're forced back in. So you've got centrifugal force, and then centripetal force would tend to make it speed up. The thing might even run itself. It was powered by a small DC electric motor. You probably have to have a brake on it to slow it down once you got it going, you know.
All right, now this Thoth, do you have any idea where Thoth came from?
Pardon? I didn't catch that.
Do you have any idea where Thoth came from?
Yeah, that's another good question. The data that we could come up with is he lived for 38,000 years, so they call him Thoth the Atlantean. So he's probably an engineer during Atlantean times. And when the poles were shifted on Earth, Atlantis could have been on the continent of Antarctica. It was mapped by the Pyrenees maps accurately to within about 1 degree of longitude, the coastline of Antarctica, but it's now covered with ice, and they didn't find that out till we were able to look down with satellites using radar to map Antarctica. But anyway, it could have been Antarctica there, or it could have sunk in the oceans or whatever, Atlantis, I mean, but they call him Thoth the Atlantean. And, you know, I didn't put a lot of data in the book on Thoth, but I had actually patented those spiral iron pipe idea. I registered it with a patent office,
And when you run a liquid metal conductor through iron pipes, it produces an opposite effect of magnetism. You see, if you run electricity to a wire, you get a low magnetism parallel to the wire, and you put a lot of coils on it, and it adds to the magnetism. But when you're running liquid conductor through pipes, it creates time anomalies, and which could reduce gravity, I think. And also, it might run itself. And it creates a time field around your general area.
All right, now,
might be,
let me ask you this, and we're going to open up the telephone lines so people can call in. And, you know, if you folks, if you have a question or a comment, we want you to have the opportunity to call in and make your comment or ask your question. But the question I've got for you is, let's say that the moon is indeed the property of Thoth, and that he brought it here and put it in its current orbit. Is he still around running the thing, or is it on its own?
Well, that's a good question, too. He could be around. We don't know. We've never heard any record of him dying, you know. There's actually probably more than one civilization involved here. This may be some small civilizations on the Centauri group, 4.4 light years away. You've got some old stars. One of them's heading toward us from the north, the Barnard star. It's 5.88 light years away, and it's heading toward us at around 16 kilometers a second. So there could be civilizations there, you know, within our cluster of 90 stars that are around us, that are concerned with Earth and would like to see it develop and like to see humans become conscious and get off the planet. This is probably the last chance for any kind of intelligent life to develop and get off the planet. You know, it's an incubator, a nursery for beings to get out and become conscious and become part of the galactic community, you know, and we're kind of screwing it up the way we're going with our greed over burning carbon and you know, we just need to get a handle on where these carbon resources came from in the first place. They didn't come from our sun. They were made by light that came from other stars.
All right, let's go to the telephone line. And, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, it's Kevin from North Bay, Ontario.
Hi, Kevin.
Hello there. Hello there, Hank. How's it going?
Great.
Hank, have you ever done any research on any of the Sumerian writings?
Yes, of course. I have pictures of the monuments around in the ancient Iraq in the book, where there's two suns in the sky and a moon, and possibly there were two objects and a moon at that time.
Do you think that, judging by things that have been happening today, the building of secret of underground bases, and well, they tried to keep it secret, that hasn't worked out too well. All these underground bases and concentration camps that they've been building all over the country and all over the world, especially the underground bases, do you think they're expecting something big to happen again, like another flash ice age or some other calamity that some of the world elite are going to need to go underground again?
Yeah, I believe that humanity did have to go underground in the past, and there's a lot of weird stuff about the human genome. You know, maybe we were mixed with pig DNA at one time. You know, why do the Muslims now don't want to eat pig or pork, or the Jews? Why do, you know, maybe it's like eating your brother. I don't know. all these bases and a lot of the underground tunnels were probably made by past civilizations, and there's probably been four or five of them that actually got off the earth and went somewhere and did something, you know. We're just being held down here as captive slaves, apparently.
Is something big expected to happen again, like another Earth-wide cataclysm, or perhaps even solar system-wide cataclysm?
Well, you know, they talk about the 10th planet or Nibiru or whatever coming in, but I did quite a bit of research on that also. In order to come in and out of the solar system, you have to travel about 44 kilometers per second. Now,
Halley's Comet, I think, comes in at 66 kilometers a second. That's why it's able to leave. In order to come in and leave, again, you have to travel a certain velocity, and that's a pretty high velocity, so our chances of encountering such an object again, or actually having it being orbited around the sun, are very remote. So, you know, we're not going to get fried for a very long time. I don't think anything's going to happen, except that we are lining up with a galactic plane, and we'll have some increase in cosmic radiations from all of the billions of stars that are lined up. And, you know, we're kind of lining up with that, and that may do something to us, or magnetically, or I don't know what it's going to do to our brains magnetically. But there will be an increase in input of photons to Earth, so maybe your garden will grow better, I'm hoping, you know.
All right, thank you.
All right, Kevin, thanks for the call. 623-444-5889 is the number to call. And if you need to call me on the toll-free line, feel free to do so. It is 888-223-4599. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin, Hank. This is Julia from Texas.
Hi, Julia.
Hi. Hank, I had called the other night about the moon possibly being a ship, and I had just always thought it was. And I wanted to go a little bit farther and say this, and so I will tonight. I had always thought it was the Ark that people always think of as the wooden boat, and I never could wrap my mind around the Ark being a little wooden boat. But when I started thinking of the moon being a ship, and I thought of the different civilizations that would come if they had a chance to come to go to another place that they could live, another Earth, and that it would be different people from different civilizations coming to do that. What do you think about that?
Well, a truly highly advanced civilization doesn't need a planet to live on. See, humans are, I believe, we evolved here on this planet, and we have these territorial instincts where we want to fight and kill each other over land or over resources. Well, that isn't really necessary if you're an advanced civilization. You can develop technology and live in outer space. You don't need a planet. You know, planets are basically bacteria baths where you're subject to all kinds of microorganisms, you know, in the soil and the air and everything, and animals and germs breeding all the time, you know. A really advanced civilization probably wouldn't even want to come down to the planet's surface. You know, it's just a concept that we humans think that we have something really valuable down here. Well, it may not be that valuable in an advanced civilization that doesn't need coal, oil, or limestone. You know, more valuable to advance DNA, to make a more complex, more intelligent being for future times, to where you develop these nurseries and, you know, get better DNA out there. That's what appears to me to be going on. You know, we're being manipulated. We hear about abductions, people, you know, taking skin samples and all that. Well, I wrote another book called Home of the Angels. You'll see it on my website, which is Alaska Publishing or GuardDogBooks.com. And it has to do with a friend I met, a guy who grew up in Arta, Florida, and he had all kinds of extraterrestrial contacts, and I tape recorded his story and put it in the back half of that cute little book.
And what was
there.
The name of that book?
Home of the Angels. Home of the Angels. It's on my website.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Julia. Yeah, 623-444-5889 is our main number. 888-223-4599 is the toll-free number. Now, the toll-free number works in the USA and Canada. Anywhere else in the world, the number to call is 623-444-5889. Of course, the country code is 1. If you live outside of the USA and you live outside of Canada and you don't want to make that international long-distance call, you can send me a flash message. Just send it to, well, the link on my website. Just scroll down and click the link, and it'll automatically get you through the spam filters, and it will get you get your message in front of me. We call it a flash message because when you send it, a little notice starts flashing on my monitor over here telling me that it has arrived. Hank, there are a couple of ancient writers, ancient Greek writers, who talk about a time when there was no moon. So they would be talking about a time prior to 11,700 years ago, right?
Yeah, I believe that's so, and I didn't actually run across their writings, but I did come across some stuff that came from the Rosicrucian Society, and I did put it in the book about the time when there was no moon up there. Also did research on cave paintings all around the world, everywhere on the internet, to find out if there was actually a picture of the moon up there dating prior to the 12,000 years ago, and there isn't any. The oldest moon we can find is around 9,000 years ago in China. It kind of looks like a moon anyway.
So what you're saying is that the cave paintings from beyond 9,000 years ago don't show a moon.
Well, you'd think they would have noticed it up there because it would have been much closer to Earth. Now, here in Kenai, Alaska, I did find some carved stones on the beach. There's one location where you find hundreds of these carved stones that are circular. They look like they've been cut on a lathe, and they have a groove cut in them that's circular. I have a couple here in my museum display case, and they have this perfectly round object at about the same diameter as the moon in relation to the circle attached to the side, as if they're trying to say, here, look what happened. You know, the moon crashed into the Earth right here. That's what it looks like to me anyway. I have the two or three of them here in this display case, and they found hundreds of them on the beach north of Nikiski, Alaska.
All right, now you talked about earlier that when the moon collided with the Earth, that number one, you think that was done on purpose and that Thoth is the one that did it. And you said also that people living all over North America and all the animals living on the land were sort of quick frozen. But you also said that there were probably four or five civilizations of highly technological people that probably got off of this planet. So let's go into that. Who are these people that got off the planet?
I recently found a notice where they had really well-carved flints and stuff dating back millions of years. In North America, the guy has a really good collection of them. I could email you the article later on, but I don't have it in the book. I just came across it recently. So, you know, we were talking millions of years, and the whole history of human habitation on the Earth has only been, what, 300,000 years or 200,000 years for Cro-Magnon man, modern man. You know, he just suddenly appeared out of nowhere as if he'd been cloned. Maybe he was cloned in the Garden of Eden, you know.
Could be. Certainly, genetic engineering is very definitely described in the Genesis account of the creation of Adam.
It certainly appears that way.
Mm-hmm.
If you do a search on man older than coal, you'll see some skulls or skull caps and other bones that were found in coal seams, they think are 30 million years old. There's a lot of stuff out there that, you know, they found bones in gold in the gold mines buried 60 or several hundred feet underground in various times. They found a hammer very much like modern mining hammer. There's also a mine in Scotland, I think, with 60-pound hammers, and there's no human on Earth can lift and use the wield a 60-pound hammer. These guys had to be 12, 14 feet tall. I used a 20-pound sledge to remove a big pin out of a backhoe, and I could only swing the thing about five or six times, and I was exhausted.
All right.
I can't imagine swinging a 60-pound hammer, you know.
Well, apparently there was a time on Earth when everything, all of the animals were larger than they are today. Why was that?
Well, it was we lived in a hyperbaric chamber. I mean, everything was lush. Dinosaurs weighed hundreds of tons. You know, I mean, humans are probably large, too. They talk about finding skeletons in America of Indians possibly 18 foot tall or up to 20 foot tall. They could run out and grab a buffalo under each arm and take it back home to the teepee, you know. That would be...
mm-hmm.
They probably had a stride, 5 or 6 foot stride, so they could probably catch up with a buffalo.
And why are things smaller now?
Well, we've lost the atmosphere, and modern humans may be the descendants of creatures that were hunted by the giants, and the giants died off because of lack of food during the last cataclysm. Actually, there were actual giants on the Earth when Magellan went around Cape Horn. And there's documents of finding people 8, 10 foot tall down there, and they have drawings of them wearing hides and a young couple meeting Magellan on the beach there.
All right, we have to step away for a break, and when we come back, we'll continue talking with Hank Kroll, the author of Cosmological Ice Ages, and the telephones will be open for your calls. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Henry Kroll, the author of a book called Cosmological Ice Ages. The telephone lines are open at 623-444-5889, toll free 888-223-4599. Or if you're outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, and you don't want to make that long-distance call across the ocean, you can go to my website and click where it says Flash Message. Type in your question or comment and send it, and I will get it, and we will read it and deal with it here on the air. All right, Hank, I want to ask you a question now about these intelligent races. Were they living, and when you say intelligent races that got off the planet, were they living at the time when there would have been giants? Secondly, were they giants? And thirdly, how did they get off the planet?
Well, apparently there's giants discovered, giant skeletons and bones discovered all over the Earth. I have a map that shows locations everywhere that I got off the internet, and I also collected quite a bit of data that I have on my computer on giants. And I put some pictures of giant skulls in the book, in a skeleton or two, one leg bone from Texas or somewhere. It's 48 inches long, a thigh bone. So anyway, the skulls that they found in South America and in the Iraq area, they measured 2-liter brain capacities, which is about double the modern human brain. And some of them had double rows of teeth, so they were definitely could eat raw meat or, you know, large animals like dinosaurs, possibly.
And were they intelligent, or were they just brutes? And are they the ones that got off the planet?
Well, with 2-liter brain capacities and 6 fingers and toes on each hand, they say that it requires more brain power to manipulate the extra digits, you know, quite a bit more. So I assume that they were extremely intelligent. Now, taking lessons from modern history, for example, Europeans were basically starving to death over there. Whenever they get a cold snap, they would have famines in Ireland and England and Europe because all they had to grow were grains, wheat, until we brought the potato over there. And then once the potato got going, they had with cow's milk and potatoes, they had a complete diet. And this freed up a lot more people that didn't have to work in the fields. And so they developed factories and they developed technology and That was the potato actually caused our technological development over there in Europe, and then they moved over to America and colonized America. So it's amazing what a little bit of food, the extra food, allows the living standards to be a little bit easier. It can allow free time to develop and invent things and construct things. This is just taking lessons from modern history now. So that could have happened in the past. They had adequate food, but it would have taken a time of starvation to get them motivated to where they, you know, started building stuff and developing the technology. But I'm sure it happened. You're talking millions of years here.
Okay, so then how did they get off the planet? And where did they go?
Well, they probably used different technologies that we're not familiar with. And I did a lot of research on how you could reduce the mass of your spaceship. I believe there's four ways, including the one that Toth used, by creating a time field around your ship. And the only reason I'm familiar with this sort of thing is I studied it for about 30 years on End State, writing a book on the Philosopher's Stone, which is also on my website. End State was an orbitally rearranged atom, and it was patented by a gentleman who lives right down there in Phoenix, Arizona, named David Hudson. And some of the most brilliant men on the planet helped him get 22 patents on what he calls orbitally rearranged monatomic elements. Are you familiar with those?
Yes. Yeah.
It's known as the Philosopher's Stone. Well, mm-hmm. These are rearranged atoms that have all the protons in the center, and they're like little magnets, and they push apart. So the nucleus is 8 times larger than a normal atom. It's 8 Fermis in diameter, and the electrons orbit and pair up in opposite rotations, and it creates a time field around there because they're orbiting past each other twice the speed of light when they're Cooper paired. And if you fill the electron orbits up all the way, the stuff disappears from third dimension. It doesn't exist in our time zone. And Hal Puthoff and other people helped David Hudson get those patents on orbitally rearranged atoms. It's also known as the Philosopher's Stone, and because they're such large particles and the atomic forces within the nucleus are much weaker, so you can reach in there and pull out a proton or two, and then flip it back into 2 atoms with a magnetic frequency, and presto, you've got a different element. You know, it makes transmutation of elements possible, which all our physics and brains on the planet say is impossible, you know. But anyway, go ahead.
I was just listening to you.
Well, you know, I spent a lot of time on that book, too, about 15 years, and I started writing the stuff down about 12 years ago on that one, and turned into a manual. It's got actual recipes where you can extract the stuff, 7 recipes developed by Pfizer. You can take it out of sea salt and granite powder and Dead Sea salt and Great Salt Lake precipitate and other source items. Any spring water will do if it's mineral laden, and it exists in high quantities, and our bodies use it for cell division. And because the mitochondria, I believe, can use magnetic frequency to rearrange these orm atoms into any element that's needed for complete cell division. So if you eat more of this stuff, you can become more intelligent. You raise your IQ level up, and I believe we need that right now here on the planet. People in America eat food grown on the same soil for 200 years, and you know, there's very little trace minerals in it. Back in the old farm journals were talking about mineral depletion way back in the 30s.
Okay, but now are you suggesting that these very, 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 very ancient peoples had developed a way to do this monatomic arrangement of atoms?
Oh, yes, it's the most perfect food, you know. When they opened the Great Pyramids, there was this white powder laying all over, and our scientists called it sacred sand. They also call it the sacred Hebrew powder, MFKZT powder. They found a gold mine, you know, over on the Sinai Peninsula in 1948, excavated that. There were 6 rooms that measured 10 foot by 12 foot. And one of them had 4 inches of this mysterious white sacred powder in it, and they didn't know how it got there. And it blew away. They didn't know what it was. Couldn't test it. We didn't have the technology to test it even to know what it was. And soldiers uncovered repositories on the island of Crete in Greece over there. And there were 20 by 20 foot storerooms underground. And I heard about that here in Kenai. There was a soldier over there digging those out. And they were looking for gold, see. But what they were throwing away and digging through was gold burned into a white powder. Now, you can take an ordinary gold nugget, you can put a stun gun on it for about a minute, and you can actually turn that into a white powder with a stun gun. And the gold will help your, you know, longevity, and platinum group metals will help with intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it's vice versa now, I'm forgetting here.
All right, now, okay, but now, that would presuppose, then, that these ancient people had the technology available to them to create the electrical currents necessary to do that.
Possibly. The word arctos means electrical discharge. In the Ark of the Covenant, they carried this around in this material. You see, it'll escape through glass. You have to put it in a Faraday cage to keep this because of the shape of the atoms. They're shaped like Saturn. They got a ring of electrons. They reproduce electric fields, magnetic fields, I should say, magnetic fields with no loss of power. And this makes them fit the technical definition of a superconductor in that they magnetically resonant couple with themselves and each other, and the signal is non-local. So what they did is they carried the Ark of the Covenant around with this white powder in there. They could have had the Staff of Ra in there and a few other artifacts, but I don't believe it was the actual Ten Commandments. Those are already memorized because they had to repeat them every day while in Egypt. They're almost the same as the Egyptian Book of the Dead. I shall not commit adultery. I shall not steal. And it was recited by the Pharaoh every morning in the pyramid. They use this Ark as a transmitter to transmit brainwaves into the people's heads. They were basically a mind control society. I believe every society on Earth in the past has eventually developed the technology where they can control everybody's minds. And this is what natural evolutionary path of any government wants to do, is to control the people's minds eventually, you see. The America is wonderful in that it broke away from the church and broke away from the King of England, the Royal Masonic Lodge, and formed the Constitution over here. Those are actually freedoms that were well thought out prior to the time Jefferson wrote the Constitution. Freemason carried over from ancient Greeks when they invaded England. All of those ancient...
Okay, laws. But...
They didn't have slavery until they colonized America, and then they had to have someone to cultivate the fields and to develop the country and clear the land, so they...
Yeah, but I think we're getting a little bit far afield here from the question of, you know, the technology of the ancients. We'll come back to that in a moment. Let's take this phone call. Caller, your first name and from where are you calling from?
Yeah, good evening, Joe. That's Terry from Wyle.
Hi, Terry.
Hi. I got three quick questions. One, you talk about that white powder. What chances you think it's manna? From heaven, and I just wonder if you know what manna means, like, is, what's that, you know, what is that? That's what manna means. And two, is the Ark, I've seen where, portrayed where, the arms that they put on to carry it, I've seen it two ways, where it's, long ways, through the front and back, and then I've seen it where it's the short way from, you know, side to side that they carried this. And do we know which one is actually true? And also, three, the spirit destiny, you know, it always keeps showing that Jesus was stuck from the right side through to the heart, but it's my understanding that it was through the left side. And I'll listen offline. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for the call. Okay, the first question is that the white powder that was in the Ark, is this what they were calling manna?
Yes, I believe that was the food that they carried with them to add for the priests. It was King Solomon made most of his money, I believe, not mining gold, but burning it into the white powder and then making bread. He was selling bread to kings and princesses.
All right, we have to step away for a break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're on Final Approach, and my guest is Henry Kroll, author of Cosmological Ice Ages. So the first question that Terry asked was about the white powder, and you were talking about that Solomon was baking that into bread and selling it to kings and princes, etc.
Right.
All right, the second question is the arms on the Ark of the Covenant. These are wooden poles that were slid through some rings, and he said some people have it with the poles going down the sides of the Ark and some going across the ends of the Ark. Which way was it? I don't know. Do you?
Well, it's just common sense that they would carry it long ways because they had to carry it in and out of the temple, right?
Mm-hmm.
And which was a tent that the Hebrews erected out there. It was, if you go to Exodus, there's a complete description of how everything had to be made, including how to build the ark in Exodus there. You know, it's a very, basically a Faraday cage designed to carry the white powder gold and keep it in a box. It's an insulating material with gold. And there's also mention of when Moses came down from the mountain, they had built a golden idol, and he was quite irate there, and he told Bezalel to take that thing and burn it into the white powder and throw it in the stream and make the Hebrew children drink thereof. Now, that is pretty darn specific, you know, exactly what they did. And the reason what they fed this to their children, and I read that years ago, and I came to the conclusion that that was one of the first genetically engineering experiments. Moses took his people out, a million people out of Egypt. They total it up by adding up all the numbers in the numbers, and figure it was about a million. And he fed them this material, which increased their, rebuilt their DNA, and increased their intelligence and made them stronger, got rid of a lot of genetic defects and stuff, and made them more of a intelligent, maybe a superior race, by feeding them this mineral-laced supplement so that their DNA would be corrected.
All right, the third question, I don't know that it really, that you, maybe your book touches on this, I don't know. He talks about the Spear of Destiny. This is a reference, this is what people call the spear that the Roman soldier used when he stuck it into the side of Jesus as Jesus was hanging on the cross. So I don't know that your book really touches on that, but...
No, the book doesn't touch on that, but I believe that Hitler got his hands on that, and I don't know where it went now. It's probably in some British museum someplace. I've heard it being around that whoever owns this thing can... have control or power over the world or something like that.
Mm-hmm. All right, we have a flash message that I want to be sure we get to. It's from Blue in Australia, and he says, Hank, do you think we will experience a major pole shift in 2011? Furthermore, do you think the moon has biological life form since NASA and the India Space Agency have found water there?
Well, I don't think we're going to experience a major pole shift because Thoth stabilized the Earth by getting rid of the northern ice cap and centering the southern ice cap on the rotational pole on top of Antarctica. When the moon hit, I believe it raised Antarctica up several thousand feet into the air. The average height of that continent above sea level is 6,500 feet, and this is why it's very cold. It has ice all over it. It has temperatures of 190-some degrees below zero. Now, what was the other question?
Okay, the other question is, do you think that the moon maybe has biological life forms on it, since NASA and the Indian Space Agency have found water there?
Studies on that.
I'm sorry?
We did a lot of studies on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a sodium atmosphere that extends out quite a ways. It's fairly thin, but it's sodium, which is a deadly poison. It's salt, you know. And Earth gets a dose of that atmosphere every time the moon goes between the Earth and the sun. And this may affect our temperament or mental states here on Earth. You can read into that whatever you want, but as far as their life being on the moon, I'm probably, may even be old civilizations on there. There's a lot of stuff on the internet. Check it out. There's like old high-rise hotels made of glass and that sort of thing up there. The moon is quite hot on the surface. You'd have to live underground. It's about 430 rams per hour just standing there. Yeah, astronauts are complaining of the heat because what happens is we got cosmic rays coming in from the sun. They strike the lunar surface and they backscatter X-rays. That's what makes it so hot. The human body can take cosmic rays, but the minute you put a quarter-inch sheet of aluminum under your butt, what happens is it backscatters X-rays, and so-called radiation shielding doesn't do you much good. So you just about have to live underground on the moon and or in high-rise glass towers above the surface. Therefore, the radiation could penetrate your body and it wouldn't affect you so much, and the glass wouldn't backscatter so many X-rays.
That's the first time I've heard that explanation for why there are structures made of glass on the moon. That's the first time I've heard that.
It came out of my mind, you know. We just made that up, but, you know, it's just logic. You know, you couldn't live on the surface. The moon's accumulated anywhere from 20 to 50 miles of debris on the surface, and I'm sure it's hollow. There's big voids there. That's why it faces one side toward Earth. The heavy side faces toward us. It was a great deal heavier at one time because it had 200 kilometers of ice on it. And it was saltwater ice, and there's probably vast reservoirs of saltwater underneath the moon's surface. They may even have life living in those saltwater ponds. Who knows? But there's a lot of stuff out there. I can't verify it for sure that there are civilizations living on the moon and on Mars right now.
Do you think that there are civilizations living on the moon and Mars?
Well, that's what I kind of think, you know. There's pictures out there of little creatures on Mars, and, you know, they tell us that Mars has very little atmosphere. I did a little research on it today. It's only 7.8 millibars on the surface of Mars. It's 10-13 millibars at sea level here on Earth. But astronauts mountain climbers that climb Everest, they get up to the top of Everest, and the actual air pressure up there is 300 millibars. And climbers that have acclimated themselves over a period of months can actually go up there without oxygen and survive without developing altitude sickness at 300 millibars.
Mm-hmm.
But Mars is only 7.8 millibars on the surface, according to mainstream data here, JPL or whatever. And I have articles on Mars trees. Apparently, mm-hmm. There could be trees on Mars. I don't know. They look like trees anyway on the photographs.
Well, and in the summertime, those things that look like trees turn green.
Yeah.
On Mars.
And the ice caps diminish at the poles also.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of strange things. But there's also a canyon on Mars, Grand Mariner or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Can't think of it.
Valles Marineris.
Yes, Valles Marineris. And it's 30,000 feet deep, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you climb Everest and you go down to 300 millibars, so you could probably subtract that from the 1013 and add that to the 7.8, and you'd find out what the air pressure is at the bottom of Valle Marineris, and it would be probably habitable down there, providing there was enough oxygen for a human to be able to breathe.
Well, I tell you what, Henry, we're out of time, and we're facing the end of the show. I want to thank you for being with me this evening. It's been absolutely fascinating. And if you will, just stay on the line with me for a moment as I bring the show to a close. There you have it, ladies and gentlemen, Cosmological Ice Ages. Henry Kroll, check it out. My friends call me Steel Eye, my enemies do too, and you can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.